This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
I don't know about you guys, but I am really tired already. It's only day one before lunch, so oh well. But what's great is that it doesn't hinder practice at all. So whether we're feeling energetic or wiped out, it doesn't make that much difference. This is why we say it's best if, you know, we try not to get into that very human thing of tying our practice of Dharma to certain circumstances. Because inevitably that's limiting and it's quite unnecessary. Is going to remind us all to relax in our practice, but then of course that sounds like I'm tying it to certain conditions. What if our karma is such that we can't relax at some point? Or more accurately, we can't feel relaxed. Even if that's the case, this body-mind encompasses a whole world of practice. Your individual karma, so to speak, and also the karma of limitless other beings. So it's greatly liberating to see that the mysterious unfolding of practice goes on regardless of circumstance. This is the meaning of what's been called everyday mind. So that favorite story about everyday mind is the way is talking about your everyday mind, your mind of every day. forget now. I think that's sixth ancestor's disciple, Nanyue. And then maybe his disciple Ma, Master Ma, something like that. And of course, Master Ma was just like us. So when Nanyue says, "Well, it's just everyday mind," Ma immediately wants to know, how do I get it? How do I get that? Nanyue says, "Oh, if you reach for it, you'll confuse yourself." So poor Ma wants to know, how do I practice it? And Nanyue says, "Well, if you try to practice it, you'll either wind up mere unconsciousness." The blankness of yogic absorption that's really outside the way. Or you'll have some nutty idea instead. So this everyday mind is what's treasured by all Buddhas and ancestors. Sometimes it's bright and shiny, and sometimes it's dull and cloudy. However, it seems in any given moment power of the vow is there. You probably know the Avatamsaka Sutra, the Flower Ornament Sutra, it has a very, very long story about this. It features what the sutra calls a good boy named Sudana. And I just noticed this morning he has a friend who's a good girl. Somehow doesn't figure so much in the story, but she was present too. So there's a good boy and a good girl. And as you probably know, Sudana winds up traveling not just many miles in this universe, but in many universes to visit 53 different Dharma experts. Pretty much each one tells him the same thing. Not in the same words, but the same thing. His everyday mind is the mind of the immeasurable accomplishments of the Bodhisattva. So to let that vow operate means, kind of have to let go of planning mind. If you read that sutra, it's very difficult not to get the impression that we are kind of we're inhabiting the low rent district of the Dharma world, whereas all these other critters are, man, they're just relentlessly radiating all kinds of things. Racking up accomplishment after accomplishment. And here, well, there's just us. But the sutra was definitely not composed to discourage people. It's like sutra is like opening a window into a the universe where all are awakened. The energy that creates the brilliance of that universe is comes from us. Before the talk, I was sitting over there behind the bells, kind of falling asleep. And yet there is also a, an invisible brilliance that really didn't have anything to do with what I was doing. So I think the purpose of the Avatamsaka story is to enable all of us to see that we're making Sudhana's journey. And the Dharma teachers we are encountering are actually everywhere. Translator, Professor Cleary, suggests that when our minds are completely purified, the way that the Avatamsaka Sutra describes the universe is how we see. Maybe so. I'm not sure how he would know that, but that's his opinion. But if we allow ourselves to approach the world, as the Heart Sutra says, without thought coverings, just as it is, we can be surprised by the marvels that surround us. So in our sitting practice, we can allow ourselves to be surprised by whatever is happening. And give ourselves permission to relax, whatever that means in our current karmic situation. Let this ungraspable body-mind speak for itself by sitting up, you know. Balancing carefully between being really too alert and too sleepy. Letting our life unfold as we watch in silent appreciation. So that's everyday mind, and maybe based on what I've said, you realize, yeah, you can't really turn to it. You can't really get at it. To do so is to put another head on top of your head, as the old Zen saying has it. But since it's our human tendency to try to escape, we have kind of set things up so it's a little harder, just a little bit, to escape. We create as much time as possible for not doing anything. And even though our this morning's breakfast did feel kind of busy, you know, even that's not really doing anything. And the more you engage in that practice, the more automatic it becomes, and the less it seems like doing anything. We're just, as the chant says, eating to support life and practice Buddha's way. So that's what should dictate the shape of our retreat. And the shape of our retreat will be dependent on what all of us give. So no two are exactly alike. No two retreats are identical, even if the same people are there. So you're sitting, you know, arrange the body so that everyday mind sits comfortably. That's why we say, you know, don't have to lean, because when you lean, you're already kind of struggling with gravity. Right? So don't lean. Utilize the body's natural integrity, by keeping the back kind of straight, but not straining. Keeping your head upright. Letting your shoulders down, and some people like to say, let the shoulder blades move down the back a little bit so that the chest is open. Breathe fully, but without forcing yourself. A while ago, I was sitting next to someone, and I was amazed at how fast the person was breathing. At first, I thought, well, maybe he ran here. But then he kept breathing that fast, so I thought, well, maybe he just doesn't know that it's okay to fill the lungs completely, let the abdomen expand completely. Let the breath travel all the way down to the bottom of the abdomen. And then when you exhale, like Suzukura, she says, put just a little bit of strength in the hara, just a little bit. And then as you finish exhaling, let that go. Again, draw the breath in. Let the breath travel all the way down to the bottom of the abdomen. And this is a relaxed way of breathing. And allows everyday mind to spread its wings. It's awfully nice sitting in this zendo when it rains. I love the sound of the rain. Maybe it'll continue a little while. It's very soothing. And you may notice then that there's a everyday mind has its own brightness, which is kind of unhindered by what we think of as bright or dull. Paraphrasing the sixth ancestor, you know, we don't say there's no practice and verification, but you can't get at them. So, just let it be. I'm afraid I'm putting some of you to sleep, so maybe there are some questions or comments. Usually the group is small, nobody has anything to say, so that's all right too. Oh, yes.
Where does the Heart Sutra say mind without thought covering?
Let's see, we say without hindrance. But the Sanskrit version, anyway, uses the word avarana, which means to cover over. So there's various translations, but one translation it would be without thought coverings. The mind is unfrightened. So we say it a little differently in our chant, but it's basically the same thing. Yeah.
You know, I think I identified with the young girl who didn't go anyplace. And
I'm not sure she didn't go anyplace. It's just
she didn't go on a. Well, my mind went.
That sutra, I don't think tells her story, but I had the feeling that her story was there someplace.
Well, I have my own story then in connection with that, because I was thinking, I probably stayed and did the dishes, and not wandered around. And I was thinking that. Seems to be a lot of times my everyday mind. There's, you know, the household things that have to be done. That's,
yeah.
And I don't know, is that everyday mind? Or how is that different from someone who hasn't heard the Dharma, who takes care of family and, you know, goes to work and does the dishes?
Well, it may not be different at all. But the person who hasn't heard Dharma may not appreciate that non-difference. They might feel, well, some people who just take care of the house, do the dishes, are perfectly happy. But sometimes people feel like, you know, they'd rather be an astronaut or something like that. But I guess my point was that Suddhana's journey to 53 different teachers all occurred in the kitchen. So that's why I kind of felt like his little friend, the good girl, she was on the same path. But for whatever reason, the person telling the story of the sutra wanted to go into some detail about what the good boy had to do. But, yeah, Sujana's journey all happened in the kitchen. And, of course, is happening now with us.
Do we cultivate the mind through practice, or does it do it by itself and the choices we make?
How do you mean cultivate the mind?
there's everyday mind, right? And there could be everyday mind sitting up, right?
Yeah.
Which might be a little different and might have a different outcome.
I'm not sure I followed that. You said everyday mind.
It's just like everyday mind, and then it could be everyday mind while we're practicing.
Oh,
It had a different effect on how we relate with other people. And
Well, genuine everyday mind doesn't really have all those distinctions. It's what's with us all the time. So when we're engaged in formal practice, yeah, it looks a little different, feels a little different, but the point is to realize that it doesn't actually have those distinctions. And that realization helps a lot when it comes to encountering other beings. We'll be less likely to think, for example, well, I can't really deal with this. I better go sit sesshin, and then maybe afterwards I'll be able to deal with whatever's happening. And that, of course, isn't so. A Dharma friend told me that one of her students urgently demanded to see her in practice discussion. And she came rushing in and plunked herself down and said, I have to sit a sesshin right now. 7 days. My friend was at some pains to get her, okay, would you calm down a little bit? Tell me why you think you have to sit a 7-day sesshin. Something was, you know, bothering her, or coming up, or being difficult. So the way to fix that is sit a sesshin. Like, well, no. Actually, we sit sesshin so that we're not imprisoned by ideas like that. It's true, you know, we feel different after a retreat. Sometimes as a honeymoon period, you know, a day or some hours, or I can say weeks, but I don't think I've ever had it last weeks. Days sometimes, you know, sort of, oh, this is very nice. This is how you're supposed to feel all the time. And then, of course, causes and conditions change, and you don't feel that way. So some people then think, okay, now time to go have another retreat so I can feel like that again. It's like, no, that's a trap. That's trying to get at everyday mind or practice everyday mind rather than let everyday mind be practiced. Oh, sorry. I was falling asleep there.
When Sarah was talking, I was made me think of the story of Martha and Mary.
I was thinking of that too.
And if I remember correctly, Jesus says to Mary, who's sitting at his knee listening to his teaching, that she has the better half. And Martha,
who was doing the dishes,
gets a little upset.
Yeah.
And that's always struck me as like really kind of weird from a Zen angle anyways. It's like, mm-hmm. First off, where does Jesus get off telling Mary that she's got the better half? Mm-hmm. And if Martha had it all together, she'd just stomp in there and say, hey, wait a minute, doing these dishes is just as good as mm-hmm. anything else.
Well, my sense of that story is that it wasn't that Martha was doing the dishes, it's that she wasn't quite there.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how I take it.
Mm-hmm.
And Mary was like there. And I think Martha could have been there too, doing dishes or helping with cooking, whatever she was doing, but she was kind of a little ways
fuming
off.
In the kitchen.
Maybe fuming or like, well, that's just those guys or whatever, but she wasn't quite there.
Yeah.
I don't think somebody like Jesus wouldn't condemn doing dishes or cooking. That would be just stupid. So that wasn't what he was talking about. He was something talking about, like, where is she? I can't quite reach her. Whereas Mary is sitting right in front of me, and she's very present. Of course, you can also sit right in front of somebody and not be there. Mm-hmm. I've done that. So anyway, that's how I think of the story. And of course, contemplative Catholic orders look to Mary as the example, right? Not being busy in the world. But I don't know if that's quite the point. And you must know something about that. Mm-hmm. Yes. Right. Well, I guess we could sit a little more and have lunch. And then, as I said, I have to go to the doctor, so David will be in charge, and Jim can help out, and you'll do something, you know, whatever. My appointment's not till 4:30, but there's a bit of travel involved, and I don't know how long it'll take me to get back. I'll probably have to walk, because being squashed to death on the metro during rush hour is something I just soon avoid. I'd rather walk. So anyway, I'll be back as soon as I can. So you have everything you need right now. Thank you.